He's President of Elmer, Gruenberg, Navarre, Cotton, and Son Chair. For us today, we have House Bill 65 and 143 and House Bill 44. Where is it?
44.
Right here. And we have a little committee action here on House Bill 44 to start with.
Did we notify Representative Don?
Well, rather than waiting to the end of the meeting when everybody leaves, I want to do it in front of the meeting this time. But we made a motion last week amending some sections of this bill that
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Scott.
Well, I had a lot of remorse over the activities that we got involved with on this bill. And I missed the first hearing, so it was kind of interesting that we had raised everybody's fees, but we dropped out the language that was going to cost more money. And subsequently, I found out that we just raised these fees last year.
Yes.
Not very much, though.
We raised them $5, and this was another $5 hit.
Well, I guess one of the things I want to take care of is on page 3, this is a new CS, we made an attempt to put 1 and 2 together. Actually, we made a motion to do that, and the drafters have come back and said if we do that, this bill becomes about 15 pages long because of the cross-citations to these sections and through the rest of the statute. So to lay out a course of action here, what I'd like to do is rescind our motion to pass the bill out of committee, and then rescind that motion, if we could, to combine 1 and 2 together and leave them separate. And then if you want to take up the fee issue, we could do that.
I'll offer a motion to rescind our action on leaving the bill from committee.
Okay, motion to rescind our action passing out committee substitute for House Bill 44. Any objection? Hearing none, the bill is before us.
And I'll offer to rescind the motion which combines number 1 and number 2, subsection B on page 2.
Okay. Motion to, I guess that's what I do, rescind our action and adopting a motion that combines 2810.421B1 and 2, and the motion would be to leave it as is an existing, the wording as an existing statute. Any objection to that motion? Hearing none, that's adopted. Now we have in front of us a bill that we've amended. Now, section 6 of the bill, pages 3, 4, we've raised the entire license fee rate what it's in statute, we added $5 to every category. When the bill came into committee, it had $1 added to every category. I have no heartburn one way or the other, but what's the pleasure of the committee? Representative Ulmer.
It is my recollection that the $1 per fee increase was to cover some cost associated with what we were doing even before the amendments which we added and then subsequently took away, and if that was Representative Donnelly's way of making it a zero impact. So it was going to go up to one anyway to cover Representative Donnelly's proposed changes. When you're looking at 51 versus 55, my logic to go up to 55 is round it off to fives. And it isn't that expensive a license when you compare it to what you have to pay in other states. We have what I would describe as a pretty low-cost fee system anyway. Admittedly, you did take it up last year, but you hadn't moved it up for many, many years prior to that, and I don't think the new amounts are outrageously expensive, so my preference is to leave it with a $5 increase instead of just a $1 increase.
May I inquire?
I'd like to know Representative Taylor is now trying to...
What the present proposal that's in front of us does is it does that for everything except for pickup trucks.
The motion that we took rescinding that action corrects that on the page. We are back to a $5 increase on every category.
I understand.
That's not what the CS shows.
But we rescinded that motion.
The CS is not technically been moved yet.
I'm telling you, what's in front of you now after our rescinding motion is a $5 increase on every category.
Right. And so to get you where you want to go, Sam, we would have to do what's on the CS on line 2 on page 4.
Yeah, that's just sort of a periphery issue to me. And I didn't want anybody to misunderstand that the reason I wanted to do that is because I owned a pickup. The reason was I thought it was illogical for us to charge less for a motorhome than for a pickup truck, when really, I mean, I think a large number of people in Alaska use a pickup truck just as another person might use a passenger vehicle. Mm-hmm. And as long as it's not commercial, there's no reason that I can figure out to charge more to license a pickup than to license a passenger vehicle. And apparently somebody at one point thought there was a good reason, but I still don't think there is a good reason. It's not because, I mean, like, we also own a motor, you know, a passenger car, so it isn't like...
The question is politically, if we do this, that certainly will be flagged around people who see the bill, and everything was raised $5 except the pickup truck. I don't care. I don't want to burden Representative Donnelly's bill.
But it's there's one way to accomplish that, Sam, and that's to take that language in one after the word or on page 3, line 26, the motorhome language.
Or motorhome?
Well, just move it into category 2, and then it would be equal with pickup truck.
I think we're going to core the motorhome.
I'm just saying, if you want to get that way.
How does that affect the revising of the
That statute? Doesn't affect anything, because in all the categories, well, I can't say that it doesn't. I can't say that it doesn't, but I wouldn't think it would.
Mr. Chairman, at the risk of being unfair to pickup owners, many of whom reside in my district, I think if we do anything in this bill, with either A, pickups, or B, motorhomes, that's going to be controversial. It will not technically be with, yeah, I guess it would be within the title, because it talks about vehicle registration, but I would suggest we do that in separate legislation, which may go to the Transportation Committee, etc. I think we should just raise it $5 across the board if we're going to do it, rather than having a one category that's different than anything else, not fight that battle in this bill.
Representative Moore.
We're spending a lot of time about $5, but I happen to agree that a motorhome shouldn't be in with the passenger vehicles. It ought to be at least in the trucks, but maybe I'd have a judiciary bill to accomplish that.
I'd suggest that neither issue is within the jurisdiction of this committee, and we shouldn't be amending either the price or anything to do with pickups. It ought to be done by the appropriate committees, and this isn't one.
Representative Taylor.
Yeah, I'll move we rescind our action concerning the $5 and and return it back to the committee substituted that came before us, which was with a $1 increase.
Objection.
Okay, the motion is to lower it from a $5 increase to a $1 increase on all categories. Those in favor? Taylor, Cotton, Son, opposed. Ulmer, Bloomberg, Navarre. Motion fails.
I move that we adopt the CS for House Bill 44 Judiciary as we have previously adopted with that which we have rescinded today.
Okay, the motion is to pass out committee substitute for House Bill 44 Judiciary as amended.
For the purpose of clarification, that would then on page, it would be just as we have the document, except on page 4, line 2, we would have the bracket around 40, and then we'd have 45, and that would be underlined.
That's where we're at.
Okay.
Further objection?
Representative Taylor?
The only purpose that I heard in this committee for increasing the amount for licensing in the state was so that we could get some reporting back. Right. We've now excluded the reporting back provision. I think we are making a mistake by reporting still out in this fashion. We should go right back to the sponsor substitute then on his number. I'm happy with both. I'll withdraw my objection.
There's no objection. The committee substitute passes. Sign up sheets here if anybody wants to change their mind. This bill is gone.
Taylor said do not pass. Everybody else said do pass.
Okay. House Bill 65. Thank you very much for all your patience on that committee.
Would somebody please let Representative Donnelly know?
I already did. I'm sure that he could feel the vibrations on the floor.
If you hold that for a few days just in case.
Okay. House Bill 65.
Why is the flag down today?
The first female who served in the Alaska Senate, whose name I can't remember.
Oh, yeah, Anita Olson.
Before us today, we have House Bill 65, the dissolution of municipality, and House Bill 143 relating to banking and securities. So I'd like to see if we can finish up our action on House Bill 65. We ask for the Local Boundary Commission decision, which should be in front of you, and we have Mr. Bettysworth here with us, who is the chairman of the Local Boundary Commission.
No.
CB, you want to join us at the table?
Yeah.
Representative Hoffman, you're free to join us at the table if you'd like to find a chair. not sure who all is coming, but if you could state your name and your affiliation and testimony, appreciate it.
My name is C.B. Bettisworth. I'm a member of the Local Boundary Commission and have been elected the assistant chair of the organization. I'm not chairman.
Okay.
It's my understanding that you're interested in first, a couple things. One is our position on Hospital 65 and also what happened at Akyachuk that became the sort of the initiative or impetus for this.
There was also a third issue that came up is there was a question of why you couldn't have reached out a dissolution of that village without amending the legislative statute. I think Representative Bloomberg was looking at the existing statute and found that it looked like you had authority to do it anyway. But perhaps you can address that issue.
Okay. I'm not, on the third issue, I'm not sure I can lend much to that, but the other two I can. I'd like to begin with talking about Akyachuk a little bit. As you're aware, by reading through the material that's been supplied to you, we actually made two decisions on Akyachuk. The first decision fairly soon after the hearing was held out at Akyachuk, and the reasons why we found against or did not approve or did not accept the petition were that, one, they hadn't demonstrated that they were free of debt, and the second had to do with the business of whether they met the minimum standards for incorporation. We reconsidered that issue. And that was the second decision that came before us. And at that time, they were able to demonstrate that they were free of debt. However, we still said that they didn't meet these minimum standards for incorporation. They still were acting as a city. They were still getting money from the state and revenue sharing. Essentially, from everything we could tell, they were behaving as a city, and their intention was to move the activities of the city into a community council type of arrangement, essentially give them over to the IRA. I think if you've read all the way through that second decision, one of the things you'll find in the back is that we had made a recommendation that the administration and the legislature take up an amendment to the current legislation so that we could resolve this problem, which we saw as sort of a catch-22, that there was really no way you could get out of being a city unless everybody just left, that there was there wasn't anybody there anymore, and that there had to be some amendments that would allow these smaller municipalities to dissolve if they found it was in their interest. And that was that recommendation was actually before you last year, and it had been the department's feeling that they could handle this by regulation. I will say that the commission did not like that because they brought those regulations to us to approve, and we would not approve those. We said it really needed to be a legislative action. We felt like we were being put on the hot seat on this. So, I have to say that we, with respect to the current legislation, we fully support the concept of legislation. We have suggested a few changes, and they have been, I guess they are currently included within the Senate bill, but they have not been added to the House bill yet. I guess the other thing I'd like to say is that with respect to Akyachuk, we're in court with Akyachuk, the Local Boundary Commission status. They're suing us on our opinion. And the status of that, I think that the briefs have all been exchanged if there hasn't been a hearing before the court yet. With respect to the third issue, I guess the way we read this legislation is, and we've talked to the Attorney General's office about this, and they support us fully in our decision. Basically, they have to meet two categories of standards. One is they have to be out of debt, and then they have to be either not meet these minimum standards or cease to use all of those powers. Well, they still met the minimum standards, and that's what our decision said. They had ceased to exercise the mandatory powers. And they basically hadn't met for a year or so, but they still met the minimum standards. So I guess that's about all I could offer on that issue. Now, answer any questions.
Representative Taylor?
Yeah, C.B., can you tell me what the benefit is? I've heard a lot of philosophy and stuff. Nobody told me what the benefit is for dissolving the city.
Well, you know, I think the department was fairly strong when we held our decisions and we were out there meeting with the people. And standpoint that from a financial or economic point of view, it wasn't to the benefit of the municipality. However, when we really look at it, what we find is that in that village there of 400, there are currently four entities of governmental or quasi-governmental units. There's an IRA council, there's a city government, there's an REAA, and there's a village corporation. And for 400 people, it was a very complicated system of taking care of their lives. And what they see is it's one of the ways to eliminate part of that complexity. And I think, I will say that, the record is with respect to dissolution doesn't demonstrate it. The commission is, I think, sympathetic, has empathy for the people's position on that. And there's a lot of other villages in the state that aren't second-class cities that operate through community councils and IRAs and do just as well and of similar size and similar circumstances.
Doesn't CB, a second-class city, have the authority to tax?
A second-class city does have the authority to tax. But it has to be approved by the voters.
Right. Does it also have eminent domain?
I'm not sure about that. Are you saying that they have to be...
I think it does, doesn't it? Do any of these other entities have the ability to tax or eminent domain?
No, they don't.
Well, then that's obviously a very important benefit, isn't it? Nobody can ever tax you because none of the entities left have that authority. You never have to pay any taxes to anybody.
Well, Accutark currently doesn't tax. At least it's my understanding they don't tax. They don't have property tax. They don't have ad valorem tax. It occurs to me that they may have a sales tax.
Is an assessment made through CNRA as to whether or not they have any tax base?
We didn't. Well, the Local Boundary Commission can do that.
Any other questions this evening? Representative Greenberg?
Yes, Mr. Bettisworth. You said that there's a city council, an IRA, an REAA, and a village council. Is that right?
Or just the
village
four
corporation. Corporation.
That's what I meant, the corporation. Yeah. Village corporation.
There's also another layer of entities that are involved with that have to do with the region itself. There's ABCP.
No, I'm not talking about that.
A whole bunch of other entities.
I'm not much of an expert on the IRA concept. If in this particular case, and obviously this is not the thrust of this bill, but it may be something that would be of interest to Accutark, if they're concerned about how many groups, governing groups they're in. Is there any way of combining, or could state law in any manner say that if it is part of an IRA that the city council can, the IRA council can function as the city council or something like that? Would that be of any help?
No. The way in which the department contracts with unincorporated municipalities or unincorporated communities is that they have provisions in there for how decisions will be made and how services will be rendered, and those some civil rights issues that are dealt with in that contract, and the way in which the money is spent is dealt with in that contract, and that's the way in which in unincorporated those kinds of problems taken care of. So the council itself actually, whether it's a community council like in the case of Polk, which is down in the Kenai Peninsula, or whether it's IRA in the case of, say, NOAAPAC or Accutark, it's a contractual relationship then with the, in the case of Accutark, that's not true, but if we're dissolved, it would be a contractual relationship between DCRA and them.
No, that wasn't what I was asking. If a village, a small village, says, we have to have, under present law, or we have an IRA, we have an REAA, a village corporation, a board of directors, and a city council, and we would like to simplify our life. And I gather that's what they're saying here. One way we can obviously do it is to dissolve one of these. We can't dissolve the REAA or the village corporation council, maybe not the IRAs, but we can dissolve the city council. Is there another way of getting them to a method where they can simplify their life without having to dissolve the city council? Because what I hear Representative Taylor saying is that there are a couple of powers that we think as a state that it's important that this particular group may have, and that is we may not be able to fully fund the operation out there forever, and they should have taxing powers. And also, they may need to exercise eminent domain, and they should have that power too. Is there any method that we can, as a state, help to simplify their life by maybe allowing one of these other governing boards, particularly like the IRA Council, to serve as the city council?
Well, I guess I'm not the person to ask about that.
Okay, well then I won't I do have one other question, Mr. Chairman, and that is, if you are in litigation now, are you in litigation on this legal question? Is that a question that's before the court?
The one you just asked?
No. Is one of the questions before the court the construction of this particular statute?
Yes. And in fact, if this statute passes, then the court question will be moved.
See, normally, if somebody's in litigation or the state is in litigation, the legislature doesn't get involved until the court rules adversely to the statute. And that's generally the policy. If the local government moves into court, then unless it's some extraordinary circumstance, we wait until that case is finished. And one of the reasons, frankly, is because we don't want to have to you to have to make any statements that may be used adversely against the statute and your position in court when we question you here. And I'm wondering, is there a reason why we need to pass this statute when you're already in court and we shouldn't follow the normal procedure of abstaining?
Well, I would interject, that is not a normal procedure. We have passed laws many, many times while we've been in court. Separate accounting is one of the issues right there that we eventually won. Nonprofit aquaculture suits, we passed those while we were in court. I can name two or three.
I've always been under the impression that the general rule is we don't, unless there's some emergency. Well, or the mental health trust lands, of course, is another issue,
yeah,
too, but there are exceptions.
Oh, you see it on appropriation measures, too.
Yeah.
There's a dispute, and then there's an appropriation to settle the dispute.
I think
Molly Hoos.
Maybe we just did it on the little cases, Max, but all the big ones around, I've seen that we've managed
to pass
legislation.
That's because the big ones go on and on. It's like the melody.
Settlements. Okay.
So
I had a question here, CB. In the original bill, there was something dealing with the succession of the assets, giving the local boundary commission the authority to distribute the assets to the state, another municipality, a nonprofit corporation, or a native council. And the committee substitute in front of us, I don't see anything in it dealing with any direction on distribution of assets. Is that covered under the existing statute?
Yeah. 2906520.
That says that the government succeeding to the dissolved municipality succeeds to all of its rights, powers, duties, and assets and liabilities. In that case, I guess it would be the state.
Right.
Because we're the government that would be succeeding to all the assets of the dissolved municipality.
Yeah. And if there were a borough, it could succeed to the borough.
So is there any discussion that these other entities are governments to which the rights, powers, duties, and liabilities, assets could succeed to? The IRA Council?
On the part of the commission?
Yeah.
Yeah, what we've seen is that, and I guess what we've recommended is that these go to the state and then on a contractual basis be then either be administered by the state or on a contractual basis then those services go out on contract to one of the entities that's in the region or within the municipality or in the community.
Well, I assume there's some municipal assets in this case. We're talking about broadly across all this.
That's right.
Law is not good to supply to Hackensack, but there must be a power plant there or some other assets owned by the municipality.
There's a sewer and water system.
Water and sewer system. Yeah. So it's your understanding.
Those assets would go to the state and their operation would go to the state and we would expect that then the state would contract for their operation.
That's in a case like NOATAC, which is not even a municipality. They have a water sewer system in there that belongs to the state then.
I can't answer that question.
Yes. Okay. Is there any other questions, Mr. Bettysworth?
We're going to have other witnesses.
Yeah, I think so. CB?
I have one other comment. As I mentioned, we've we've made a couple of suggestions for additions to this bill. Actually, it's only one, and that is to add a section that deals with what we call a best interest standard. And what I would do is refer you to the Senate substitute bill has a best interest standard in it. We're not saying that it has to be in there, but we would recommend that it would probably save a lot of grief in the long run if that standard were included.
Is that a new section that we don't have in one of these?
Yes, and I don't have a copy of that with me, so I can't really give you the language.
We have a copy of the Senate bill. I'm not sure that's the right version. We have someone from the Attorney General's office here. So maybe you could. Any other questions of CB? Is it in this
Yeah, it's in the committee substitute for the Senate. So.
Maybe you could briefly just explain that. Okay. Or
At line 27, it says, if the commission determines that the municipality meets the standards previously described, and that the dissolution of the municipality is in the best interest of the state, it shall be, it shall accept the petition. Essentially, what the way the current bill is established, there is really no review on the part of the, I mean, there's no review on the part of the local boundary commission. Basically, it's a petition. We make a basically administrative finding that they've satisfied these couple of items, and then they hold an election. And we think there needs to be another, and that's the purpose of the local boundary commission. I mean, that's how they got incorporated. We need to go through the same process to get as part of the, to get out.
Okay, I also noticed another, if we're going to compare it to the bill from the other body here, that this bill in front of us has a two-thirds of the votes cast threshold, and they're talking about 50% of the people registered to vote in the municipality. What's your opinion?
Our opinion is that we don't really have an opinion about the 50% versus two-thirds. We're concerned that there be a high threshold, because this is a real important decision. It needs to be up there.
Well, I think the threshold of 50% of the people registered to vote is probably a higher threshold than two-thirds of those voting.
I don't know.
In some of the villages, that may not be the case. They get something in the order of 100%.
Very high, particularly in your district. There's lots of voters. They all turn out, don't they?
That's for the petitions, the line 29.
I think, Representative Hoffman, your district had about the highest percentage of anybody in the state voting.
Well, I tell you, if it was in my community, if it was 50% of the people registered to vote, we'd be having a lot of elections. So.
Doesn't say that, though. It says 50% of the votes cast in Washington.
Well, that's the people that have to sign the petition. On line 29 is the actual election, where it says two-thirds of the votes cast on the question. I don't know, which do you feel to be the higher threshold, or which one did the boundary commission?
Well, I think the two-thirds is the higher threshold.
Okay. Any other questions of Mr. Bettisworth? Not? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
The Attorney General's office, Dave, you have some comments to make? Or?
I don't have any other comments other than that if anybody wants to put in a little legal question that arose before, I can try to answer.
Representative Grunberg.
Yes. What are the issues before? Is this in the Superior Court level now?
Yes.
Whereabouts is it being?
In Bethel, Judge Freeze.
Oh, okay. And is it a question, a legal question that's before him, or is it a factual question?
As I understand it, it's almost entirely a legal question, namely how you interpret the existing statute, what it takes to dissolve.
I see. And could you just very briefly indicate the arguments on both sides?
Well, the argument on the state side, now I'm not the one doing the case, so I'm not totally familiar with it, but the argument that Mr. Bettisworth gave, as the commission's view, is basically the state one, that if you read the present statute fairly strictly, that even if a municipality meets the having taken care of its debts problem, that they still cannot dissolve if they are actually continuing, if they have the things that would enable them to incorporate.
So in other words, the question really turns on the construction of the word and.
I don't have that before.
Well, if you look at the, you have the statute in front of you. If you look at the word and in line 12, the state says it means that you cannot dissolve unless it's both free of debt and these other requirements are met.
If it were or, that would take care of the legal problem. There's one way of taking care of it.
Is there another? I see that issue. Is there something else that we haven't been hasn't been explained to us yet?
It's the question of the real argument is about what meets the minimum standards prescribed for incorporation means, and whether that should be taken literally to mean that if you have 25 or more people and whatever the other minimum ones are, that you can't dissolve. Now here you've got a community which could, if it were not incorporated, incorporate, meet that requirement, and does in fact carry out the functions that the municipality does now, albeit largely through the village council rather than through the municipal government. And the question is, how does that apply to the statute? There's no doubt that the statute needs some clarification. All the villages that are considering dissolving the municipal governments are going to be able to tell whether they can or not.
Are there other things that should be done to this statute to clarify it, as well as what we're talking about?
I don't think so. I think the things in this bill would be.
Is there any other questions of Doug? Representative Taylor?
I could look it up, I guess, real quick. Can you recite for us off the top of your head as best you can? What are the authorities in the second class here?
These are
the
Those aren't restricted. All right.
That's what
I'm saying. I don't think it's
My name is Doug Griffin. Basically, the second class city is very basic. There's limitations. They cannot levy a tax, property tax higher than 5 mils. They cannot levy a sales tax higher than 6%. Those are basic limitations on all cities. The property tax is a very restrictive one. In fact, it almost excludes making sense for any second class city to levy a property tax, because it's, you know, 5 mils and basically you probably pay for your assessment and maintain that type of that system of taxation. And then basically, as far as powers, they may exercise planning powers, but it's not a mandatory thing, and basically everything else is just whatever powers they want to take on and provide. It's not really anything mandated that they have to.
Do they take a vote of the people, you know, like if they want to expand and go to road powers or water and sewer, each of those take a vote like a vote on a girl?
That's correct.
My concern, Mr. Chairman, is that we're dealing here. Yeah, thank you, sir. I appreciate that. We may be dealing here with the problem that will be facing all of our smaller communities in the near future. If 1991 passes without significant amendment to the Native Claims Act, all of that property then becomes taxable. It also loses its status at that point as being subject to PL 8-1, 874 payments. Now that is a significant amount of revenue which is presently all utilized in those areas. For education purposes, it is the funding force behind all of our REAAs. Now, when that occurs, there's going to be a significant drop of revenue for educating kids. There's also going to be a huge land base available for taxation purposes. Now, if you're not a city, you don't have to tax. At that point, I assume either the state's going to have to start doing something about taxing lands in the unorganized boroughs of the state, or implementing some sort of statewide sales taxes or other forms of taxation, and then reimbursing those communities who are taxing themselves and divvying up the money for those who aren't. But to go through this thing at this time, I think, sets a precedent that's somewhat dangerous, because we're allowing these people to then remove from themselves, if you will, the opportunity to ever do any of the things that are allowed in here but are not allowed by just being a village corporation. I think it's a very dangerous precedent.
Yeah, I think we got two issues here. One is whether or not people should be municipalities or not municipalities. Secondly, a mechanical issue of if you ever make a choice to vote to become a municipality, can you ever unchoose or go the other way? And it seems to me that we mechanically don't have a method for ever changing your mind, and that's what this bill here is. Now, whether it's good policy to change your mind or go back, I'm not sure, but I think we're dealing with the mechanics here more than the policy issue. Is there anybody else here to testify on this bill? Do you have any comments, Representative Hoffman? Or?
Well, I guess in response to Representative Taylor's remarks, taxation power and whether or not the state is going to tax the unorganized borough I feel is a completely separate issue, and that is being addressed in a bill that Representative Larson has submitted, and by dissolution that would not preclude that from happening.
Yeah, I would take the point of view that the legislature is the borough assembly for every place in the state that doesn't have a borough, so you know, we have the authority to do that. But okay, if there's anybody else testifying on this bill? Doug? Could you identify yourself?
I'm Douglas Mertz, Assistant Attorney
General. Well, personally, I kind of like the Senate best interest statute here. I don't know if that's a want to get through here, but I would move that we adopt, I guess, on page 1, lines 22 through 26, I'd move that we delete the language in the committee substitute in front of us and insert the section 2 of the Senate bill, CSSB 50 CNRA that we have in front of us. And that would adopt the language and the rationale that Mr. Bettysworth pointed out to us regarding the best interest finding by the Local Boundary Commission.
So your motion is to substitute their Section 2 for our Section 2?
That's correct. Any discussion? Any opposition? Hearing none, that's adopted. On the threshold question of the two-thirds, it appears, if my math is right, that it breaks even on about a 75% turnout. That if you have the 50% of the number of people registered to vote, if you had 400 people registered, you'd have to have 201 votes. But if you had the language we have, two-thirds of the votes cast, if you had 300 people turn out, two-thirds of that is 200. So it's about, that's kind of the balance. If you have a 75% turnout, the threshold we have would be the higher versus 50% of the registered voters. I don't know, if you have less than a two-thirds turnout, then you don't make it. Representative Bloomberg?
I must confess I have some of the same problems as Representative Taylor has with this and the taxing base we're looking at. But if we're looking at legislation, I would prefer to make this, I'd prefer to make it more restrictive for the municipality to dissolve. And what I would offer as an amendment would be that and we're looking here at the final section of the bill. It would be, if the dissolution is approved by the greater, whichever is greater, either two-thirds of the votes cast on the question or 50% of the number of people registered to vote, whichever is greater.
Whichever is greater.
Quite sure mechanically how that works.
Well, we can get that drafted by legal counsel. But the certification to pass the question would either have to be 50% of the registered voters or two-thirds of the votes cast, whichever would be the greater number of affirmative votes.
Representative Hoffman?
Oh, I guess I would object. I don't think that any other proposition or that any other municipality would have that type of a restriction placed on them. And I think that either one of these is restrictive enough. It's requiring a two-thirds vote is very hard to come by. And I would submit that any other community in the state, if they were to have that requirement, would not pass very much legislation or any proposition.
If I may respond,
is there a minimum number of votes that have to be cast in an election for the election to be valid? In anywhere. I mean, if two-thirds of the vote cast, I mean, if you have 400 people, I mean, 10 people show up, right? Six mm-hmm. people say yes, and you've done it.
Right.
I'm just wondering if there's some minimum threshold that there's none that you know of. Mr. Bettysworth?
Doesn't the legislation say it was two-thirds of the votes cast in the last
election? No, it's the petition has to be signed by 50% of the number of votes cast in the last general election to get the petition in front of you. But at the election, the dissolution approved by two-thirds of the votes cast on the question with no threshold level of the number of people that even have to vote. Representative Ulmer and then Grunberg.
I don't know whether Representative Grunberg put his proposal forth in a proposed motion or not. Did you move it or did you just suggest it?
I suggested.
Okay. I would like to then move that we delete Section 3 and replace it with the Senate language, which would be the number of voters greater than 50% of the number of people registered to vote in the municipality.
I'm going to object for the purposes of discussion. The reason I suggested that was because when you're talking about dissolving a municipality, that is more important than any other question that's virtually going to be put before that municipality that I can think of. It just does away with everything in the whole governmental framework for that municipality. And I think that that should require an extraordinary number of votes. And I would therefore at this time move to amend the motion that's before us.
If you take a consideration that if two-thirds of the people vote, or actually three-quarters of the people vote, if 75% of the people turned out to vote, you would have to have two-thirds of them to meet the standard in Representative Ulmer's motion.
Yeah, I quite understand.
So you're at a two-thirds level in most elections, and if you go under the two-thirds, if only 50% of the people turned out to vote, you can't make it. If you had 60% of the people turn out to vote, you'd have to have 75% of them voting yes.
I understand that, but the reason I'm saying that is because, from what I understand, in some of the areas of the state, they traditionally have very large turnouts. And so if you have a large turnout, and I just think it's such an important issue. I don't know. I'm not out there, and I'm not about to second-guess the people. I don't know. I'll withdraw it.
Well, you're right. Anything between 75 and 100% voter turnout, then the number of people casting a yes would be less than between 50 and 2/3%. It would vary up in the 60.
I'm not trying to be hard on the people out there.
Representative Hoffman.
Okay, I'm not going to. I won't. I withdraw my motion. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, the language that we have right here in Section 3 in the Senate version has been deleted. The committee has a new language before them in Section 3, and it was passed out along with a letter of intent that the Senate Judiciary Committee adopted that the committee may want to consider.
I guess my only question I have on the two-thirds, I'd like to put some minimum level of voter turnout in there then, if we're just going to go with that. We have a motion in front of us to adopt it.
What is the language that this, what does the Senate have now? Did they go back to the two-thirds vote language?
Well, let's worry about what we should do here.
I'm just curious what they've done. I think it's a proper question. What has the Senate done?
I think they've eliminated it.
They totally eliminated it?
It says line 2, section 2, insert new, is amended to read. But I don't have any problems with, a minimum of 50% of voter turnout with a two-thirds majority of that vote to pass the initiative.
It doesn't look like they dealt with this provision at all. It looks like they inserted a new provision on an entirely different section of law.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, just to clarify, my motion does not require two-thirds. It requires 50% of the number of people registered to vote in a municipality.
Right.
Your comment is that may result in requiring.
Representative Ulmer's motion. Ulmer, Gruenberg, Navarre, Cotton, Sun, Barnes, opposed.
The amendment? No, I was for the amendment.
Okay, unanimous then. Okay. If they have a great deal of high voter turnout out there, it'll be less than two-thirds approved, so in their control. Any other comments on this bill, Representative Bloomberg?
Yes, I would like to look at the language that the Senate did add on Section 3, and I'm wondering if somebody would speak to the advisability of not considering that language. Do you like that language? Or
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Hoffman?
I think the language was more for timing purposes,
right.
So that because many of the people in our area are gone during the summer months to fish camp and doing a lot of subsistence taking during the summer months, and they were trying to pinpoint a time when the elections could be held.
I have no problem with that.
I don't have any problem with it.
Okay, I would move that we amend AS 2906510A as set out in front of you to add in the timing language. It would just provide that the election should be held basically between November and April, if I read it correctly. Is there any objection to the motion? Okay, having none, I'll adopt that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, any other amendments on this bill? Comments? What's the pleasure of the committee here?
Substitute. Move the bill with individual recommendations.
A motion to move committee substitute for House Bill 65 as amended with individual recommendations. Any objection?
I object, but I have a broad objection.
Okay, objection noted and withdrawn. bill.
Mr. Chairman?
Moves onward. Representative Grunberg?
It seems to me that the letter of intent, the Senate letter of intent, is very good.
I have some problems with it.
Oh, okay. Where?
We'll just wait for that to occur.
I don't know if do you want to say anything?
Well, I think that, Matt, you need to study what that thing really says. And under 3, they're saying, i.e., dissolving primary to void a viable tax base. If you go back to the beginning of it, it says existing laws apparently blah, blah, blah. Such circumstances include those where, 1, the residents of the community have abandoned their city government. 3, the dissolution would not be adverse to the interests of the community served by the city, the region in which the city is located, and the state, i.e., primarily devoid of viable tax base. I don't really think that language should be stated like that, and I don't know exactly how to do it yet.
Oh, what they're saying is that the best interest would require a finding of all 3 items, because there's an and at the end of number 2.
We could take up a letter of intent at any time. We need to deal with the bill here. But
I would prefer that you do.
Sure, okay, that's no problem.
Those of you who are concerned with the letter of intent can work on. Okay, I'd like to move on to House Bill 143. This is an act relating to an assessment of civil penalties in Alaska Securities Act, providing for an effective date. We have Willis Kirkpatrick, who is the Director of the Division of Banking and Securities. Mr. Kirkpatrick, if you'd like to join us at the end of the table. And Jeff, are you here on this issue too? Jeff Bush from the Attorney General's office.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Willis Kirkpatrick, Director of Banking Securities Corporation under the Department of Commerce and Economic Development. House Bill, committee substitute for House Bill 143 is an act that in its first section allows employee benefit plans the ability to go ahead and issue employee stock without a filing with the administrator. After several years of reviewing filings, we've never found any particular actionable filing events. So for the corporation having to file for a reduction of work for the administrator, it's suggested that these filings be deleted. However, such deletion doesn't delete them from the fraud provisions of Section 455510. Under Section 2 of the Act, it does, as far as penalties, it does 2 things for us. In one instance where we had to take action against a broker-dealer, where the broker-dealer as a corporation had some wrongful acts, rather than close the broker-dealer or summarily suspend the trading for the broker-dealer, we could levy fines. When we suspend the activity of a broker-dealer, we also suspend the activity of those salesmen who are working for that particular organization who may have not had any knowledge of any violation. So it gives us a provision to be responsible in enforcing the Alaska securities laws without passing on penalties to those people who are agents and not a party to the violation. Another area where it would benefit greatly is an area of where we have multiple violations, where we have a person who is who's soliciting unregistered securities. We issue a cease and desist order, giving them an opportunity for a hearing. They usually do not respond to the opportunity to hearing. The order goes permanent. Then we find that they're issuing another unregistered security. So what we're doing is that we're laying cease and desist paper on this individual. He's adhering to that particular cease and desist order and just moving on to another security. In one instance where Jeff Bush has been involved, we've had this fellow into court for subpoena of information, and we find that the expense of our action for this fellow is all the state's. The case brought to mind is what we call the Elmer Pratt case. This fellow moves on to various securities. We acknowledge that they're unregistered securities. We take administrative action against him, and he moves on to another. Some judges have had some particular problems with him, but this particular individual has had no expense, other than some minor attorney's fees, but the major expense has been on the department and on the Department of Law. The final section of the act was the amended section in the last committee, and it is a piece of legislation that we asked for in the last 2 years, and that has to do with oil and gas leases that are Alaska land leases that are promoted and touted throughout the United States. It didn't quite get through last year. It did have a fiscal note on it last year. This piece of legislation would allow us to issue an administrative order against those individuals who are offering oil and gas leases, what we used to call 40-acre merchants, to investors throughout the United States, primarily through telephone solicitation. Those orders, even though they may not have much value as far as Alaska is concerned in stopping the solicitation, the states in which those solicitations are occurring, such as the boiler rooms in Florida and California, may act upon those orders and take action within their own state. We would ask, as far as the activity, increased activity that would require a physical note last year and doesn't require one this year, we would be more or less as a facilitator for other states to make those fraudulent ones at least public. That's the extent of my comments, Mr. Chairman. Jeff Bush is with me to answer any technical information, or if I may have any answer any other questions.
Representative Grunberg, looks like you've kind of taken a lead on this bill here.
Yeah.
And provided a sectional analysis for us.
Yeah, I think this is a very important, it's a consumer protection bill. And we don't have a fiscal note, and I would hope that if this committee passes it out, we could get it through. Made it all the way to the Senate Rules or Senate Rules last time. And this is the last oil and gas stuff. You remember the pictures they had of these people in Florida were saying Governor Sheffield endorsed their fraudulent scheme and stuff like that, and it was just pretty outrageous. The only thing I will ask, Mr. Chairman, at the appropriate time, I don't think this needs an effective date, and I like to keep things simple, and I'll move to strike the effective date. Do you have a problem with that? Okay. Give people a chance to gear up.
Representative Taylor?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. You referred to a gentleman by the name of Elmer Pratt.
Yes, sir.
No,
is he from Wrangell? Isn't that the guy from
Wrangell? No, we used to have a guy by that name out of Ketchikan. It was a little different.
That's true, and that's not the same gentleman.
Not the same fellow. I see. Well, that's good to know. He was strange enough to have done those kinds of things.
Okay, Jeff, do you have any comments to make on this?
Mr. Chairman, just briefly,
you need to identify yourself.
Oh, sorry. Jeff Bush from the Department of Law. This bill was, in fact, at least the penalty section of it, not the part from last year. I guess the Department of Law is actually the agency that brought up, suggested it. In part because Willis sort of touched on it, but one of the problems that's coming up is we have repeat violators. In this state right now, given the Department of Law's budget and budgetary constraints, and especially on the criminal side, it's pretty hard to find somebody to do complex criminal litigation that'll take tie up a prosecutor for 6 months or a year, which is what the general thoughts are behind a white-collar crime securities fraud case would be. So it's pretty difficult to get somebody prosecuted in the state right now. We suggested this because it would allow the Department of Commerce to issue civil fines to people who are... it still leaves the criminal violations sections intact, so that if a person is a serious enough offender, we can still bring criminal action against them. But for the small white-collar crime securities fraud cases, there was nothing we could do to stop the individuals. And so this gives us at least a hammer that we can use. That was the reason behind And I should point out, Mr. Chairman, the Labor and Commerce, the drafters at Legislative Affairs draft things differently than the governor's office does when we submit things. And this bill now reads, sections B and C on page 2 are the new sections. We had a draft so that those were all underlined, and now it's just been repealed and reenacted, so it's kind of hard to follow what's new and what isn't. But I should point out, subsections B and C on page 2 are the new sections.
May I inquire, Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, go ahead.
Jeff, we passed a bill and passed unanimously on the House floor a week or two ago, House Bill 88, that allowed for consumer protection lawsuits, allowed private causes of action by businesses as well as persons. Can private individuals enforce this to the Securities Act?
Yes.
Okay. So it's not then totally dependent upon the state budget?
No, Max, the problem, Mr. Chairman. Max, the problem is that what we run into is you have individuals, 15, 20 of them, each of whom has been taken for $5,000 to $10,000, none of whom can afford to bring an independent legal action. And more often than not, in fact, the person that they're going to bring the action against is out of state or judgment proof or difficult at least to locate. And so the cost and expense, you're right, the private citizen can bring them, and we encourage them to bring the private action.
That is just tough.
But it's tough to do.
It's okay, I'm still getting my file. I'm the chairman. I didn't have the CS. All I have is the original bill plus the amendment.
Don't worry about that amendment. That amendment is.
Huh?
Was that in Labor and Commerce?
Yeah, right.
That amendment should not be in there. That was just put in erroneously. That was that's in the bill.
I'm glad I had it because I didn't have the CS. I'm ready to go now.
Mr. Chairman, can I make a motion? I move we strike the effective date clause and the clause of the time.
Why do you want to do that? I mean, this is not going to be an objectionable bill. You're going to get it.
I figure the minority's going to
vote for it.
Okay. Okay. Fine. Good.
I mean, unless there's some reason that there should be some delay for people to get ready to get civil penalties laid on them, I'd just assume we.
Okay.
The power
I withdraw
right
the motion.
This may very well turn out to be the leadership crime package we're talking about.
That was cruel and uncalled for.
Cruel and unusual punishment there. Okay. Is there any other questions on this bill?
Do you want a motion?
I'm not. Is there any amendments we need to make to it here?
No, those were already done in Labor and Commerce. That shouldn't be in your packet.
Well, I'll tell you the truth, I'm not totally familiar with it, but. I have no real objection to the bill.
I move it, but you guys like to do that yourself.
Go ahead and move it.
Yeah, I guess the question I have is on the penalty sections. Are those civil penalties high enough? $2,500 to $25,000. You feel like it's going to give you the ability to deter this action?
Mr. Chairman, there is a revision of the Uniform Act being proposed nationally, and this meets the criteria of that Uniform Act. And we feel that this is substantial.
Are we going to see the Uniform Act? Are you guys going to propose that here?
Not this year.
Thank you.
I mean, are you looking forward to doing it next year?
Yeah, we hope to have it at least reviewed by our agency by next year.
I would just ask that if you want us to act on it, that if you could get it to our committee in October.
Certainly.
Sometimes we have a shot at looking at it in October, November, December, before the session starts. That would be very. Matter of fact, I would just let you know that if you don't, it's probably not going to make it.
Thanks.
The way this session operates, it's going to be real tough. Representative Grunberg.
I move the bill with individual recommendations.
A motion to move Committee Substitute for House Bill 143, Labor and Commerce, with individual recommendations. Any objections? Hearing none. It goes to finance. Does that have a fiscal note?
No.
No.
I don't know why it needs to go to finance.
Maybe they're going to try to collect a lot of money now.
We're going to put a $5.
No, it's just that we had
broker license plate tag.
It was that we didn't know what the fiscal note would ultimately be when we did the referrals.
Yeah, I don't do referrals, so I don't know why these things go. I'd never send a bill to finance if I had control of the referrals.
We're working on that project.
Okay, guys, 11:30 tomorrow. Representative Taylor, you're going to have
12:30.
Oh, you're right, 12:30.
I've been showing up an hour earlier, an hour late.
12:30 tomorrow for House Bill 94.
What is that bill?
We're adjourned.